let me ask you this question. Who do you trust? And some of you might be thinking right now, well, nobody. Some of you might have some people in mind. Some of you, it might be your spouse. It might be your parents. It might be a good close friend. I see some of you putting your arms around each other like, I trust you. Good, that's good. Who do you trust? Because life requires trust. There's no way around it. Driving here this morning, driving is a very unnatural thing. I'm hurtling down the road 110 miles an hour. Again, you're not following me today. I'm not going 110. So if this is recorded and the police hear this, I wasn't going that fast. But, you know, you're flying down the road and other cars are flying the other way. That's, you should be flinching, right? But you're trusting they're going to stay on their side of the road. You're trusting that when it's a red light, they're going to stop, right? There's a whole lot of trust involved in driving your car this morning that you probably didn't even think about. You just thought, get going, do-do-do, go. And then you're here, and you don't realize you just trusted probably 50, 60 people you never met to obey rules that you've all just agreed on, and that's why you're still alive right now. We trust our information, and I know this is scarier and scarier, but the truth is, all of our information's out there in the ether of the internet, right? And we try to do things to protect it, but we still shop online and do our things online. There's a whole lot of trust involved that things are going to be okay. I'm trusting right now the police in my neighborhood are keeping my home safe. Well, them and my dog, probably mostly my dog, but they're keeping my home safe. No one will break in. I'm trusting the firemen. If a fire breaks out, they're going to rescue my home and keep it from burning down. You all trusted the seat you're sitting in right now, didn't you? When you sat down this morning, did you think, oh my gosh, I hope this holds me? Or did you just sit down, right? Trust. Right now, you're trusting me a lot. Right? You're trusting me not to waste your time, to show you something or tell you something that's going to be useful and helpful so that you can grow and know God better. There's a whole lot of trust going on there. So here's the reality of life. Trust is not an option. Who you trust and what you trust is. Who will you put your trust in? What will you put your trust in? Because knowing who and what to put trust in will make all the difference in your life. In the Proverbs chapter 3, it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all of your ways, submit to him and he will make your paths straight. If you want a straight path through life where you understand who to trust and who not to trust, because that really is the key to a life that's peaceful, knowing who to trust and who not to trust, what to trust and what not to trust. If you want a life that is straight and flat and smooth, that comes by learning to trust God. So this morning we want to tackle, well, how do I trust in the Lord? Why? What does that look like? What should it look like? And I want to talk to you about trust through the story of someone, a woman named Deborah. So let me tell you her story. Her story comes in the book of Judges. So it's in the Old Testament in your Bible. It's in chapters 4 and 5 of the book of Judges. This is right after God rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt. So let's get our minds there. All right, wherever your mind's at right now, come on, zoom it in. It's right after he rescued them from slavery in Egypt. He led them through the wilderness. They arrive at the promised land. This is now the time they're supposed to be taking control of this promised land, right? And not making alliances with ungodly people who are enemies of God. They're supposed to be taking control and becoming God's nation so God can bless the world through them. God makes a covenant with them, a promise, deeper than a promise. A covenant that, look, if you obey, here's what it means to follow me. Here's what it means to be like me. Here's what I require of you. If you do these things, then I will bless you and I will be with you. If you don't do these things, then I will curse you. Right? And they agree to this covenant with God. Yes, we will follow you. We will be faithful to you. And they enter into this covenant. And then you step into this book called Judges in your Bible. And it feels a lot like the movie Groundhog Day. How many of you have seen the movie Groundhog Day? It's the idea that, you know, this guy wakes up in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. And every day just keeps repeating. And he's got to figure out how do you stop this. It's on repeat. The same thing is happening to him every day. That's what the book of Judges feels like because they say, God, we're going to be faithful to you. And then they're unfaithful. And they make treaties and alliances with all these other nations, begin to become like them, begin to worship all these other gods. And then God judges them. punishes them by allowing these other nations then to attack them and take them over and oppress them and make their life miserable. And then they realize, oh my gosh, we did wrong. So they cry out to God, please save us. And God says, okay, he sends a deliverer, he saves them. And then they say, God will be faithful to you. And then they're unfaithful to him. And then they make treaties and alliances and worship other gods. And then the other nations attack them, and it just goes over and over and so on, just like that. Over and over again in cycles. It feels kind of like you ever spin a coin on the tabletop, and at first it's tight and it's spinning and everything looks great. It looks like it's alive almost. And then as it finishes, it starts to wobble more and more. That's kind of what the book of Judges looks like. They're following God, they're tight, but then they get worse and worse, and with each cycle, they get worse and worse until they wander away completely. Deborah's story takes place during one of those times when they're being oppressed by the enemy. God allows the king of Canaan, his name is Jabin, he allows him to oppress them, and this king is powerful. Actually, he's hired the general of one of his enemies. He like went to one of his enemies and hired their general away and makes him one of his mercenary. And this guy's name is Sisera. And he is the commander of this giant army with 900 iron chariots. And with a name like Sisera, come on, you gotta be tough, don't you? Can you imagine the nicknames this kid had growing up? So Sisera is actually the one who's oppressing them. He's got 900 iron chariots, and that means that they were either covered in iron or fitted with iron fittings. That meant these things were powerful and could move and were hard to fight against. And actually, chariots weren't used to go like tanks and attack. They were used to chase people down. Sisera's army was used to winning and chasing people down and killing them. And so he had 900 of these chariots, like the most advanced technological army in the place, is this guy Sisera with all his stuff. And for 20 years, Sisera makes their lives a living hell, torments them, attacking them. Finally, the people of Israel cry out to God for help. And they say, Lord, please help us. And they go to the leader of Israel, the person who is governing the people of Israel, to ask them for help. They go to Deborah. Deborah, the Bible tells us, is a wife and probably a mom. She's also a prophet. And she's the one who is governing and leading the nation of Israel at this time. She's the one who speaks for God at this time. And she sits under this tree they named Deborah's Palm. And that tree is where she kind of rules and reigns from. Under trees is where important things happen. Judgments are made under trees. And so people come from all over Israel to her for guidance, for governance, for judgment, and for leadership, because these trees are significant. And the whole nation recognizes when we go to her that we're going to God. She speaks for God. God speaks through her. And so they come to Deborah and they cry out, Deborah, you know, we're being killed by this guy Sisera. We're being tormented and oppressed. Please, please intervene for us. Have God do something for us. We're sorry. We repent. And this is amazing, especially when you talk about a patriarchal society, isn't it? You read the Bible and people get all impressed. Oh my gosh, this is God using a woman. And some people have gone to say, oh, well, this just shows how bad it is in Israel. God has to resort to using a woman. If you hear anyone say that, don't smack them, because that's not right. But have them actually read the story, right? Because that's not what's going on. There's a tension in this whole story that you'll see about the way people view things and the way God views things when it comes to who and what is powerful. Deborah, without blushing, is someone God uses because she's faithful and trusts him. And God tells Deborah he wants this man named Barak to lead the army and deliver the people. He wants to raise up this guy Barak to go and lead the army in the battle and win. So she calls Barak to come and see her under the tree, and he comes up to her, and there she says, has not the Lord commanded you to take the 10,000 men who have responded and go to Mount Tabor? God said he will lead Sisera. He will lure Sisera and his chariots and his troops to the river there, the Kishon River, and God will give them into your hands. Hasn't God said this? And now Barak has to decide. Does he trust Deborah? Does he trust God or not? And Barak wavers. He doesn't really trust her. And so he tells Deborah, if you go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I'm not going to go. And listen, this isn't a movie. Deborah's not some elven warrior who he wants her to come so she can help fight the battle. She is not a fighter. She's probably an older woman, married with probably kids. And he's not calling her to saying he wants her to come because she can fight. He has a trust problem. He doesn't trust Deborah enough, or he doesn't trust God enough, or probably both. And so he wants Deborah to come because he doesn't trust that God will do what he said he'll do unless he has Deborah with him. Or he wants Deborah to come because he doesn't really fully trust her. And so if things go wrong, Deborah will be there to take the blame. No matter how you slice it, Barak fails to trust. Now, if you go, I'll go. But if you don't go, I ain't going either. That's what you want in a general, right? So without hesitation, Deborah responds and says, certainly I'll go with you. But because of this course you're taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. See, Barak fails to trust this woman of God. And so Barak will lose the honor to a woman, and that's how he'll know. He's going to know that this is all true and that he should have trusted it when he sees this one particular thing that is incredibly unlikely. A woman will kill Sisera instead of him. And this is incredibly hard to believe because they didn't bring women into battle. They never brought women into battle, except for Deborah. And who's she going to kill? Right? So this is hard for Barak to believe. He shrugs his shoulders and they head off. They go back and they collect the 10,000 men who have responded and they're willing to fight. And they head out to the place God told them to go, where God said, yep, go to that river and I will lure Sisera out and give you victory. So they go and they walk. And as they're going, they pass by the tent community of a man named Heber. Heber is an Israelite who abandoned his tribe. His tribe is way in the south and he's now moved all the way up north, right? And he abandoned his tribe, left all of them, took his family, took his wife and all their kids and people close to them, all his possessions, moved up north and put up his tents underneath this giant tree near the king of Canaan, near Jabin, near Sisera, and made an alliance with them. He abandoned his people and made an alliance with the king of Canaan and set himself up there under this big tree. And it's kind of like you have this parallel between the tree that Deborah sits under and judges, speaking for God, and then you've got this other guy, Heber, who goes and makes an alliance with the king of Canaan and puts his trust there under that big tree, right? And he's chosen to trust them, not instead of trusting Deborah. So Heber sees Barak and the army and sees where they're going, and he runs and tells Sisera, is what the story reads like, and tells him, hey, I saw Barak and I saw these 10,000 troops and they're all going to this area. Should be a piece of cake. And Sisera hears it, and he's like, oh my goodness, this is the perfect setting for me and my chariots. Let's go down there. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. Let's go kill them. And so there's Deborah and Barak and the 10,000 men heading into battle, and they see Sisera coming with all of his chariots, all their armies rolling into the valley, and Barak hesitates again. Once again, he's like, I don't know. That's a lot of people coming to fight, right? These guys are trained. I don't know. Look at those chariots, man. They're mean looking. And Deborah has to tell him again, go. This is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Hasn't the Lord gone ahead of you? And with that kick, he leaves the nest and he heads down. And this is how the Bible describes what happened. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and ran away on foot. So who routed Sisera? Not Barak. The Lord did it. And Sisera, who starts out this story incredibly powerful, right? He is this general with all this power, with these powerful chariots that chase down and oppress and kill everybody for 2 decades. And here he is running away on foot. Not only does he run away on foot, he runs home. He goes running home. He's a general. And he goes running home. And we're not talking like home was just a few blocks away, right? He's running miles and miles and miles, probably over the course of more than a day, to try and get home, running and hiding and running and hiding, afraid for his life. Meanwhile, Barak and the Israelite army are chasing down all of his troops, and they're just systematically killing all these soldiers who'd been oppressing Israel, who'd been enemies of God for 20 years. And Sisera sees, as he's running and running and running and hiding, he sees that great tree where Heber lives. Heber, the guy who made the alliance with the king of Canaan, Heber, the guy who told him about the troops, and he runs there because, hey, this guy's a former Israelite. No one will think to look for me there. So he runs into Heber's camp, runs up to this tree and the tent that's under there, and standing there is Heber's wife, Jael. And she sees him running and she says, come, my Lord, quick, don't worry, you're safe here. And she brings him into her tent and she covers him with a blanket. And he tells her, he says, I'm thirsty, give me some water. So she goes and she gets a skin of milk and she gives him this nice warm milk. And he drinks it, he takes the nourishment, and exhausted, he lays there under the blanket and he tells her, if a man comes by and asks, is there a man in there? Tell him, no one's in here. And then he falls asleep. But she didn't guard the tent. Moments later, Barak comes running up, pursuing Sisera. And she goes out to meet Barak with a hammer in her hand. Come, she says, I'll show you the man you're looking for. And Barak is thinking, ha, Deborah was wrong. I'm going to get the honor and the glory of killing Sisera. And so he heads toward this tent, ready to taking his knife out, probably ready to kill Sisera. He walks past Jael into the tent and sees Sisera lying there under the blanket, the skin of milk next to him, and a tent peg nailed through his head. Jael drove a tent peg through the head of the enemy of God. She drove a tent peg through Sisera's head, nailing him to the earth, killing the enemy of God's people, and taking the honor and the glory away from Barak. Now that's a story you're going to remember, isn't it? It's hard to not remember. That's crazy. But this story is not in the Bible to entertain us. It's here to teach us something. It's here to teach us about trust and about trusting God and what that needs to look like. So what does all this teach us about trust? And before we dive into what it teaches us about trust, first I want to kind of connect us here, because we're not going out and fighting battles with people who have chariots, right? That's not the situation we're in. So we can't just take this right across to our life today. We need to connect this to our lives today. So how does this connect to you and me? How does this connect to the situation we're in? Ephesians 6:12 says, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. God has called those who follow him to fight an enemy, sin, and evil. And the forces of evil, Satan and his angels. Sin is ugly and scary and powerful, intimidating, confusing, and intelligent. Evil is an imposing enemy, seemingly more advanced than anything we could ever handle sometimes. It's everywhere we look. But God has already sent our deliverer, Jesus, right? Who has struck the death blow to this enemy, knocked it off its war machine, and now, what part of the battle are we in? We're in the mopping up part of the battle, chasing down sin and evil wherever we find it and utterly destroying it, removing it, instead bringing in beauty and order and chaos, chasing out evil. This is the part of the battle we're in. That's why we should be advancing, not hiding and retreating. This enemy, this is the situation we're in, this enemy that we're now with Jesus chasing down is running everywhere, trying to take people hostage as it runs and gets away, trying to hide behind them and hide inside of people. The enemy will even convert people to fight for it, to fight for sin, to fight for evil. But our enemy is never those people. It's always the sin. It's always the evil. And our weapons are not swords and chariots and spears. They're different. Corinthians says, though we live in the world, we don't wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power Wouldn't you like a divine power weapon? To demolish strongholds. What are these strongholds? We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. We're fighting against everything that would try and diminish our trust in God. Our knowledge of who he is and what he's done, and our obedience, trust and obedience go like that. They are the same. That's the war we're fighting. All the things that try and tear us away from trusting God. We're fighting a war against sin. And as much as I talk about us as a family, church is a family, church is supposed to be a family to care for each other, that analogy doesn't fully work, because really what we are, beyond that also, is an army with a mission to accomplish. And that means that we don't just enjoy each other's company, but that we're actually working and fighting side by side. You know, a few hundred years ago, 1,000 years ago, if you said we're a family, people would understand, oh, that means that we're all doing the same work. We work the same farm. We work the same thing because it's a family thing. We're all trying to survive. We've lost that today. So we need to recognize we're not just a family. We're also an army working for God. Fighting an enemy that twists and distorts our minds. This twists and distorts our ability to recognize what is real and what really matters. An enemy that calls us and lures us to put our trust in all kinds of things that are not God. Trust humanity, trust technology, trust governing systems, trust economy, trust your own intellect, trust yourself. How can you trust God? You don't even see him. This is the war we're fighting. And so that's the context that we need to see this in. We're not fighting chariots and stuff. We're fighting a battle for hearts and minds, perception of reality. And in that battle, we need to recognize, the first thing we need to recognize that we learn from this story is this: God can use anyone to accomplish purposes. You can fill that in if you're following along in the app or write it in the bulletin. God can use anyone to accomplish his purposes. And that should be good news, but also slightly dissatisfying, right? Because look at the people God uses in this story. Obviously, JL, right? As crazy and as out of left field as that is, God uses a person everyone else there would have considered weak and unimportant and harmless. She isn't even mentioned in the story till the very last moment. God uses her to take down the enemy of God's people. Okay, that makes sense. But God also uses her husband, Heber. God uses Heber's trust in this alliance with the enemy of God to get him to be a lure to bring the enemy of God out to battle so God can defeat them and rescue his people, right? God will turn his enemies and use them in order to accomplish his purpose of delivering us, of transforming our minds so that we can understand who God is and trust him. God uses Heber. He uses Heber to go and lure Sisera. Sisera trusts in his alliance with Heber. He trusts in his chariots and his army. And God takes advantage of that trust to use Sisera and use his arrogance in order to deliver him into judgment and death, into defeat, so he could deliver his people. And so what we need to remember every time we think of this story is that God's going to accomplish his purposes. Have no doubt about that. God will accomplish his purposes to save people no matter what, and he can use anyone to accomplish that. This is a story about how God is awesome, and God is powerful, and God is great. He is. Don't ever forget that. God can use anyone to accomplish his purpose, and sometimes it's shocking who he uses and unsettling who he uses, but what that means is, one, wow, I don't have to be someone who's super important or whatever. God can use me, but it also should mean this. I don't want to just be used by God then. I want more than that. I don't want to just be used by God. If God can use Sisera and all these other people, I want more than that. I want to work with God. I want to receive glory and honor from God, right? I want to experience God's glory and honor, not just be used by God. I want to work with God. That's the second, and probably the main point this story teaches us, is that God gives glory and honor to those who trust him without hesitation. God gives glory to those who trust him without hesitation. Deborah tells Barak, you got to go. And Barak says, I'm not going if you're not going. And what does she do? She doesn't say, let me think about it. No, she immediately says, absolutely, I'll go. Think about it. She's saying, I'm going to go with these 10,000 men God, what that's gonna smell like. And I'm gonna go to battle with you guys, camp out, traveling with you all these miles, and I'm gonna put myself in danger. But I'm the leader of Israel. I'm the voice. I probably shouldn't do that. That's probably not smart. No, she doesn't say any of that. She does not hesitate. She goes. God tells her to do something. She does it immediately. Call Barak. She calls Barak. She doesn't say, you know, Barak's kind of cowardly. No, God said, call him. Barak says, I'm not going. If you don't go, I'm going. Right? That kind of unhesitating trust in God. We see it in JL too. She doesn't hesitate. She doesn't think about, well, what might happen? What will my husband say if he knows that I just broke his alliance with the king of Canaan? You know, that's probably going to get him in trouble. What might he do to me when he comes home? What might he say to me when he comes home? She kills the enemy of God's people, nailing him to the earth inside her tent under this giant tree immediately without hesitation. Within the moments between Sisera lying there and Barak running up. And there's a lot you can say about Jael. Right? It's a little bit weird, right? There's a lot that doesn't feel right about her. You know, that this is kind of treacherous, right? Why is she inviting a man into her tent when her husband's not around? That's not a good thing, especially in those days, right? There's a lot of things that are questionable, and she's not commended for any of the questionable things. She's commended. In fact, Deborah writes a song. That's what chapter 5 is going to be. Writes a song, and she honors Jael, not for these other things, but for one reason only. She immortalizes Jael and gives her honor and glory in this song because of one reason only. She trusted God over everything else, over her husband's alliance with this king of Canaan, over their powerful armies, over everything else. She trusted God and obeyed him without hesitation. How about us? How about us? Do I trust God without hesitation? When he points out some evil to me, whether it's sin or evil inside of me, or maybe in another person, or maybe sin, evil that someone is doing to somebody else, do I wring my hands and say, oh, I don't know what to do about that, God, or do I go? Say something. Intervene. What do I do? Maybe God's leading you to pray for someone, to go and talk to them and tell them about Jesus, to invite them to church, and you're sitting there worrying about, well, then they might think differently about me. They might think I'm weird. They might think I'm whatever. And that would then mess that work. They'd look at me funny. And you start worrying about all these things. You're hemming and you're hawing. You're hesitating because you're trusting really in other people's opinions of you. You're thinking that's more important for me being secure than trusting God. If I don't rock the boat with them, then I have a peaceful life. But if I do what God tells me, that's going to really mess my life up. You don't have peace until you're trusting God. You think, oh, I need the pastor, or I need a deacon, or some, you know, better Christian. Someone who's a better Christian than me. But look, if God called you to go, that means God's gonna use you. It doesn't matter who you are or what you've got. God's gonna use you to go and talk to that person, to tell them about him, to help them because they may be trapped in some way of thinking that has them lost. Maybe they're trusting all the wrong people and you see it and you know it, but you don't want to say anything. But God's sending you and saying, go. Don't hesitate. If you hesitate, you miss out on the glory and honor of what God that God has for you. You'll never get to experience that. Don't hesitate. Go. Man, even right now, if one of you is sitting here, or if all of you are sitting here and can imagine that God has actually told you something to do, and you know it, God's told you to do something. There's someone he wanted you to call, someone he wanted you to talk to, some situation he wanted you to intervene in, and you've been like, I don't know. And if that's in your head right now, and you know God's told you to do something about it, then right now I give you permission to get up and leave and go do it. Seriously, get up and leave and go do it. You can catch the rest of the message on a podcast. But if God's called you to do it, don't hesitate. Go and do it. There's nothing else more important than doing what God called you to do and trusting him to go and do it. When you trust God without hesitation, you experience God's blessing and his honor and his glory. And if that's scary to you, if that makes you kind of pull back a little bit because you're not sure you can do it, then what that means, what that should tell you right now is you have an issue with trusting God. You're not sure you really can trust God. And hold that for a couple minutes. And in a couple minutes, I'm going to tell you why you can trust God. But first, the third thing that we see in this story is that hesitation and apathy will cost you God's glory. God can use anyone, but unhesitating trust is what brings you God's honor and glory. Hesitation and apathy, they cost you God's glory. So Barak, he hesitates. He doesn't trust Deborah. He doesn't trust God. And so he hesitates. And then what does he end up doing? Something you've probably done a bunch of times in your life. I don't trust God, even though I know he's told me to do something. And then I end up chasing and chasing and chasing, running after it. Running after it, trying to just get it on my own way. You know, God, let me just build this church using my own power and strength, right? God, I don't want to have to do it by having like a good, close, real relationship with you where I just honor you. God, there's books I can read and techniques I can do that can make a whole lot of people want to come to this place. And wouldn't that be awesome and make me feel good if a whole lot of people came to this place? Right? So then I go chasing and chasing and chasing and chasing. And you know what that does? It leaves you exhausted. And then you get there and JL's driven the tent peg through the enemy of God's head. All his chasing, all of his effort got him nothing. He thought he could go grab God's honor and glory and blessing. And you cannot grab God's promises because you see them and you want them. You have to listen and obey. And then you receive them. Adam and Eve learned that, right? Oh, let's grab this being like God thing. Doesn't come that way. It comes by listening and obeying. Then we receive God's blessing. So Barak learned it. His hesitation cost him God's glory. It had him chasing all over the place, and he lost it. But then there's this other group that you wouldn't have seen in the way in the story I told you. They show up in the song that Deborah sings in chapter 5. She sings this song about what God has done and also about the people who held back. And in this song, she mentions the other tribes of Israel because only two tribes send people to fight. The other 10 don't do anything. And so in Judges 5, verse 16, she says, "Why did you stay among the sheep pens? To hear the whistling of the flocks? In the districts of Reuben, there was much searching of heart. Everyone was wondering, oh, what should we do? Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. Dan, why did he linger by his ships? Asher remained in the coast and stayed in his coves." Those are the names of all these other tribes. They just stayed home. The battle's not near us. The enemy's not really bothering us that much. So probably not that big a deal. Apathy doesn't keep you safe. The battle's going to reach you eventually. Apathy only costs you God's glory and honor. You don't get to be part of what he's doing. When we sit apathetically by at home, making our comfortable lives and not trusting God and engaging in this battle. The fourth thing, the one that scares me, is this. Trusting anything over God earns you God's curse. Trusting anything over God earns you God's curse. Sisera trusts all his chariots and his army. Trust in his power to just take whatever he wants. There's one part where Deborah writes her song where she writes, you know, imagining Sisera's mom at home waiting for Sisera to come back. And she's like, is his mom wondering where he is? Where's the clanging sound of his chariots? And she pictures his mom comforting herself saying, oh, she's probably just telling herself, oh, he's just dividing the women two to each man. Like she's pointing out his mom, this is the type of people these were, right? That his mother would be comforting herself, imagining her son, oh, he's probably not back yet because he's raping the women, right? Sets himself up as an enemy of God who's able to do whatever he wants, doesn't care about what's morally right or good. He's just powerful and he'll do whatever he wants. Trusts his treaties, trusts his power. King Jabin trusts his mercenaries and his treaties. Heber trusts his treaties. All people, they trust in these things other than God and they end up suffering God's curse. They earn God's curse. There is an enemy attacking God's creation. That enemy is sin and evil. And it's convincing people left and right to trust in anything and everything other than God. Our minds have been shaped and twisted by this culture that the enemy has created all around us, distorting our ability to know who to trust and what to trust. And God is calling us to join him in this battle against sin and evil, but we don't trust God enough. And it looks as though life would be easier if we just keep our head down, live a good life, build a good career, nice and quiet and peaceful. And without even knowing it, we're making alliances with all kinds of people and things, putting our trust in them to keep us safe and to bring us peace and bring us joy, and ignoring this war that's going on and ignoring God, the only one who can give us peace and joy. We feel the battle, but we ignore it. And sometimes that war comes to our doorstep and we can't avoid it. It comes in the form of sickness and trouble and people coming after us, losing jobs, all these different ways that it can come to our doorstep. And in those moments, we cry out, God, please help us, please help us, please help us. And for a little while, we follow God, and then we begin to settle back into all these other alliances, these other things we're trusting more than God. And we don't realize that what we're doing is rejecting God and not going to get his glory, but maybe his curse. So we never experience the glory of actually trusting God and fighting and overcoming sin with him. But if we will hear what God's telling us today, if we'll trust him enough and enter into this battle, engaging sin, engaging evil, then that is where we're gonna find peace, ironically enough. It's not by running away from this. It's by engaging it with God. That's when we find we have someone leading us who can show us how to and who to trust and what to trust. He can guide us in all these decisions about what to trust in our daily lives and what not to trust in our daily lives. We have a deliverer who goes in front of us, leading us in this battle, who has shown us what trust truly is. And the Bible tells us in 2 Peter, to this you were called because Christ suffered for you. This is God's call on us. Because Christ suffered for you, leaving us what? An example that we can follow his steps. He committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. What does that mean? You can trust him. He's not a liar. He is perfect. You can trust him. Verse 23, they hurled insults at him. He didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, what did he do? He entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Jesus trusted the Father. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live for righteousness instead of dying to God. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were like sheep going astray, not trusting the shepherd, but now you've returned to the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. God is calling us, calling you to follow Jesus and trust him this morning. And maybe this morning you're still wondering, there's a piece of you that kind of trust God unhesitatingly. Sometimes I got to think about it. Because you're wondering, will God really do what's best for me? And the irony of that question is that God has already answered it in the most amazing and powerful and dramatically emphatic way that you could even ever imagine. Now, of course, you can trust God to do what's best for you. Because he's already done it. Of course you can trust God to do what's best for you. He's already done it. He's already done what is best for you. Think of this story. Deborah, where did she judge? Under that tree. Because under the tree is where judgments are made. And then Jael, where did she drive that tent peg through Sisera's head? It was inside that tent, under that tree. God judged that enemy of his people under that tree. And then Jesus was nailed to the cross and dropped into the earth on a tree, judged on that tree for you and for me. Will God really do what's best for me? He already did there. He has done what is best for us. That's why we're not running away from evil and sin. That's why we can be marching through it, overcoming it, because Jesus has already done what is best for me. What is best for me to secure my life eternally with him. Not to make, you know, me have the car I want to buy. What does that mean? Not to give me the house I want to have. What does that mean? To give me an eternity. That means everything. To help me become someone who wins people and rescues them from sin and evil. That means everything. What does this other stuff mean? Nothing. Why am I trusting in that? If I am, it's only because I'm being fooled. I've been deceived. I've been tricked. He's already done what's best for me. And those who trust in God without hesitation, they're the ones who experience God's glory.